Welcome to Mulling It Over with Brandon Mole.
Hi, I'm Brandon Mole. I'm a number one New York Times bestselling author of a bunch of fantasy series like the Fablehaven series and many more.
And I'm Jason Conforto. I'm a filmmaker, a podcaster, and game designer. In this podcast, we're excited to share our love for story and our passion to create.
We hope to share a bunch of experiences and lessons learned over a lifetime in creative fields.
So look us up, Mulling It Over with Brandon Mole, wherever you get podcasts.
The episode was about something very personal that happened to me. And at lunch, I got in a van and I rode to SVU and I was with iced tea and prostitutes on City Street, New York at night.
Welcome to Story and Craft. Now, here's your host, Mark Preston.
All right, here we are back again. You and I, another episode of Story and Craft. Hey, if this is your first time stopping by the show, thank you so very much for checking it out. Today, sitting down with actor, director, writer, producer, Kevin Kane. I really enjoyed the conversation. You probably know Kevin from Law & Order SVU. He's also had a long-standing collaboration with Amy Schumer. In fact, he's won an Emmy Award, won a Peabody Award for Inside Amy Schumer and a multitude of her projects he's been involved with. And just a very talented guy. Also was in The Irishman with Robert De Niro and Joe Pesci. Really enjoyed the conversation and the sit-down, and I'm sure you'll enjoy it as well. Hey, don't forget something kind of new with Story and Craft. Substack. Check it out. Great way to stay up to date on what we have going on with the show, to get notified when we have new episodes and what have you. Just go to storyandcraft.substack.com. And of course, the website storyandcraftpod.com. Always available to you to check out past episodes, find out about past guests. And as always, if you would, make sure to follow Story and Craft on your favorite podcast app. That way you stay up to date, get notified whenever a new episode rolls out. It's very much appreciated. Okay, so let's jump right into it. Today is Kevin Kane Day right here on Story and Craft. We're post-lunch here. Did you have yourself a little bite to eat?
I did. It's been a very, very busy day here. We had we had school at home today because of the snow. And...
Oh, really? No, where are you living full-time?
I'm in Brooklyn.
Okay, you're the second Brooklynite. Is that the correct phrase? Brooklynite. I just talked to the actor Ken Leung, and he's in Brooklyn. So apparently that's
yes,
a cool place to be.
You know, I don't know Ken, but... I lived in Astoria, and there's a very famous karate school that I think Ken's uncle is the teacher at, and he used to brag about Ken all the time.
Well, that's what families are supposed to do. They're supposed to brag.
That's
like,
right, yeah.
You must know my, in like that, like those, yeah, those folks, like, you know, whenever you move out to LA, people are like, you know, oh, do you know so-and-so? It's like, LA's kind of a big town, you know, got a couple people out there, you know. but no, I'm quite envious, man. I'm always envious of people who can live in a place where you can walk and get yourself some good food to eat.
Yeah.
I finally have the kind of walkable thing here. I live on an island in South Texas, and we've got... I think 3,000 full-time residents. Yeah, that's a residence. Now, that, of course, tourism season, it just multiplies many times over. But it's only, I think, the whole drag, the whole main thing of the island is only 5 miles long. So you can walk anywhere, you know. So now that being said, I still take my car most places. I need to get out and do some walking. So now, are you originally from Brooklyn? Are you from the New York area, or did you find your way there?
I'm originally from the Philadelphia area. But then I think probably similar to where you live now, in high school, my father moved us all to Myrtle Beach, South Carolina. And, so we were in that seasonal town living for a few years there. Yeah.
Oh, so Myrtle Beach, is Myrtle Beach a big vacation destination on the East Coast?
Yeah. You know, we fluctuated. I think I spent all my summers at the Jersey Shore as a kid, and then in high school we were at Myrtle Beach, so we were always sort of close to the bar beach business most of the time.
Yeah, it is something. My I don't know if you can see him back here. My old golden retriever. He's like a year and a half old, so he's still got a lot of puppy. But he runs over to the window. Our street is how people get to the beach. And so he just loves watching people, and it's like a whole new crew every time, new dogs to bark at and all kinds of fun stuff. So so you you know, you're living in South Carolina. That's where you grew up. That's kind of your home base. Are your folks still out that way?
No, they both passed. Our whole family sort of originates in South Philadelphia. So I lived in South Carolina for a few years, and I ended up getting a scholarship to college at Coastal Carolina. So it was kind of an interesting. I ended up getting an academic scholarship.
Oh, I got a smart kid on with me.
I mean, maybe at the time for Coastal Carolina, I think it was a bit of a party school at the time. They've since grown and it's become a thing now. And it just allowed me to kind of experiment a little and take some acting electives and, you know, let me kind of touch base with some professors there that really kind of opened my eyes that like this could be a possibility for what to do with my life. And it was because where I had come from had not, you know, it was very, I always joke, for the job I have now, I have my father's family were a lot of like civil servants or coaches and athletes. And, my mother's side were a lot of criminals. So it was,
That's prepared you in a very unique way for your current
vocation. I used to laugh because, like, in Philly, like the arts, you know, it felt so weird to tell them that I was kind of going in that direction. But if I really kind of remember them all correctly, with the very artistic life they lived, they were all in string bands and in the Mummers Parade. They were rehearsing choreography for New Year's Day. They were in costumes.
What is the Mummers Parade? Because many moons ago, I worked in radio in Dallas. I'm going back to the mid-90s. And there was a song I remember playing called, it was called The Mummers Dance. And I was curious, what is that?
You know, it is this wild little secret they keep in Philadelphia, and it is just as crazy as Mardi Gras, and it's New Year's Day, and
wait. How did I not know about this thing here? So it's New Year's Day, and
it's New Year's Day, and basically what happens on New Year's Day, it's all of these clubs that are these kind of neighborhood clubs work on a theme, and they rehearse all year, and there's different divisions. Some divisions, like the bands, all play instruments. Some of them are just costumes and choreography. And they basically compete against each other in front of the judges down in Center City, Philadelphia. And it's intense. It's wild. It's like it's so huge. And it becomes such a wild kind of parade. Everybody has an open house. Everybody has a bar and hot food in their living room. You can walk into anyone's house and hang out.
That does remind me. I did live in New Orleans for like 20 plus years, and it reminds me of the Mardi Gras crews down there. They're like, they're clubs basically.
Yeah, and I'll tell you, what's really connected is, you know, these bands go, they spend all day going up Broad Street, or it's Market Street now. And they would, come back down into their neighborhood, like South Philly, and like open their private clubs that they've been working at. You can't get in all year. And they're really just a bar, and they open it up to the neighborhood, and they have a party on the corner of where their club is. And most of them will hire New Orleans bands to play for the rest of the night because they've been playing music all day. Now they're taking the night off and partying with, and so they would have a lot of Mardi Gras bands come up and play.
That's a big thing. There are all these, for weddings and big corporate events and stuff. It's kind of a thing to rent out a band for, you know, not a cliche, but you have a New Orleans wedding, you got to do the second line dance. But that's cool. Yeah, I have heard of these private clubs where.
And when I say private clubs, you know, like it's just a little members thing for the neighborhood. Right. The whole family's involved in getting the whole club ready for New Year's Day all year long. They rehearsed.
Now you've cleared up a mystery I could have very easily Googled many years ago, but I just remember the song came out, Mummers Dance. I was like, what's a Mummers Dance?
It's funny. When we were doing the second season of Life in Beth, we got to shoot in Preservation Hall, and we put Ben Jaffe in the show. And Ben Jaffe, like whose parents founded Preservation Hall, mm-hmm. were from Philadelphia. And he grew up in New Orleans, and he's so entrenched in the New Orleans scene. And I would have these conversations with him. I'm like, it's such, there's such a weird connection I keep feeling. This is before I knew his parents were from Philadelphia. And then when I knew that, I said, oh, wow, that was something they must have been always gravitating around, you know?
Preservation Hall, that's right there in the, that's kind of one of the main arteries of the cultural scene down in New Orleans, you know? So that's very cool.
Yeah.
Now, going back to when you were in school in Carolina, when you were there, what was the initial acting bug caught there, or were you know, through the elective process, or was it after?
Yeah. I think I've always had this weird fascination with it prior to me being able to acknowledge that it was something I could do for a living or that it was something that I would be a part of. It was just a kind of a fascination and interest. My mother found this trick when I think it was like in the fourth grade, we had to do a report on any artist. And the caveat from the teacher was that the artist had to be born before 1900, because at the time they thought we'd all be doing like Michael Jackson or anybody contemporary at the time. And so my mother learned that Jimmy Cagney was born in 1899. She knew this fact. And so I did the report on Jimmy Cagney. And as just this young kid started watching all these movies from the 1930s and 1940s, it just made me bounce out of that idea as a kid of watching movies and kind of Star Wars and all those things that you're just, that is your entertainment, and start watching, this guy did this. He lived a life. And how do they make these things, and how does it change? And old movies became like not a scary thing to me. It became a thing that I would investigate. So I was already like, those things were already circling around my head. I knew actors, I knew directors, I knew things like that. But I think in college, it was like no stakes for me, and I just had the freedom to kind of step out and scare myself with it.
You're I guess Gen X kid. What were you watching outside of Jimmy Cagney? You know, what were you watching? What was the stuff you were consuming at that young age?
I think, I was really just, the 80s were these, I found like the typical, like the Star Wars, the Indiana Jones series. Those things were just kind of event type pictures. But I think through that, and I guess the family from Philadelphia cliche, you'd find a movie like Rocky and you'd notice it was smaller and it was different. And I think through my older cousins, I'd find these movies from the 70s. So I was really kind of digging at film. I feel like I was watching Hal Ashby in high school, wondering what was going on here. This kind of secret that I had, it was like diving for like deep bands or something like you would do.
Well, it's really interesting you mentioned that. You had your cousins who watched stuff in the 70s. See, I've always thought, I was born in 73. I always felt like I was on the starting to be on the younger back end, because all the Brat Pack and all that were always a few years ahead. So, the older Gen X remember the 70s, or that was part of their ecosystem musically, movies. All that was definitely in the 80s. The 70s were just like, that was my older cousins, just like you, like music, but it was a great time to grow up. Whenever I discuss it with my kids, I'm like, I remember when I worked in radio, one of my first years on, I was 90, I think. And we still had we had Michael Jackson. We had New Kids on the Block and Aerosmith and Two Live Crew and all that. I mean, the music was all just kind of mishmashed. We had like all the best stuff that was just kind of rolling, and here you are working with Ice-T, so that's
I tell them all the time, I used to have that Body Count. That was like a little secret contraband cassette we'd all sneak to pass off.
Wasn't that right about the time they started rating, putting those like warnings on the cassette?
Exactly.
Yeah, the cassettes. And that's one thing I hope they never bring back, cassettes, because, you know, they talk about bring back vinyl. That makes total sense, bringing back vinyl. Yeah. There's no reason to ever bring cassettes back. There's just not. Maybe an 8-track. You never know. They were better quality. But no, the whole tape thing was just, you know, with the cassettes.
The world doesn't have time to rewind anymore.
So you started, this thing was firing up for you. Would you say you kind of caught the bug when you were young? Was you just, you st- like the Jimmy Cagney thing, was that just sort of something that just kind of held on to?
I think I was around, a lot of, I grew up in the bar business. We were kind of Irish cliches, you know, like I'd watch, my uncle was an Irish singer and a comedian, and I'd watch these people entertain from afar.
Well, a bar is a stage. But I was
and there was a stage there. Yeah.
An actual stage.
It's weird. Philly can be a very throwback place. Even my grandmother and her relatives, they'd have their song they'd sing with the piano player at the bar even when I was a little kid, you know. Everyone had their chance to get up and entertain. And I was just a crippling, shy kid. Like, I didn't want any attention. My brother's 4 years younger than me. If like we were in the mall and I wanted to ask directions, I'd make him go up and ask somebody. Like, that's how much I'd want to avoid attention all the time. So I think in college, it was more of like, it was just touching a fear mostly, you know, and trying to satisfy an interest. And then I found good results with it, and I got really encouraged to do it. And the second I graduated, I moved to New York.
I think it's part of the ecosystem of people who do this thing that being shy is probably it's the norm, it seems like. When you're younger, you know, being shy and you know, not trying to draw attention. Either that or somebody is on the opposite end of the scale, very gregarious.
Yeah.
Now, so the New York thing, was it what made you choose that as opposed to going to LA?
I think I you know, using that like Jimmy Cagney, like I kind of parlayed into studying all these other actors and the 50s and the Actors Studio and all this stuff. And I started realizing like a lot of the actors that I most admire sort of were New York based and theater based. And I wanted to do theater. And so it kind of made the decision for me.
Who's like on your Mount Rushmore? Who like you mentioned like 50s actors, or who are the ones you looked at and you're like, yeah, that guy's cracked the code. I need to keep an eye on him or her.
I could kind of do it by decade, like, cause I have so many that I kind of appreciate, but I've always been like a Daniel Day-Lewis or a Sean Penn or, you know, as a kid, you get into Brando and De Niro but then you read like, I don't know, I read this amazing book of Carl Malden's autobiography, and it was, I getting lost in some of those kind of worlds that don't exist anymore. Yeah. Really, it's not what New York is anymore. But I think, you know, I guess at any age, if you would have asked me that, I probably would have still named those people, but I would have different names to add, because I think you're always constantly changing, and what you appreciate and how you kind of navigate this business is gives you a whole nother level of appreciation of like how hard some things are and how hard it is to stick to it.
Well, was there any kind of magnetism that was pulling you in the direction of comedy or drama or some kind of specific thing you're like, or even like Star Wars, you know, that was a sci-fi thing. What was it that was a brass ring you're reaching for in a specific genre?
I didn't really. I really kind of wanted to just, I don't think I ever thought of pursuing comedy. But I think like a lot of things for me, it was like in retrospect, I was like, I knew way too much about comedy to say I wasn't interested in it. You know, I knew so many comedians, and I knew so many comedic performances and directors, and so I really did come here as a blank slate, but I think I always had in mind those kind of big swing roles of actors that were versatile, that could do everything, you know?
Because we grew up in the era of back when Saturday Night Live, you had like Billy Crystal, you had Eddie Murphy, you know, you had that was kind of the golden era of comedy. You know, you had Sam Kinison and all that kind of stuff. And then, but you had people that were all like Robin Williams, who's also doing the dramatic thing, you know, so maybe that was.
It was incredible. And I always kind of had this idea of that. It wasn't, there wasn't a road to go down to like identify yourself as one thing or the other. And it kind of organically worked out that way for me. I don't know. You know, all of a sudden I found myself in the middle of all this comedy and working on this comedy that you know, I our training was the same, you know, it was the same kind of work. Sometimes in comedy, you just kind of have to inject a little steroids into the stakes, but, it just made me just kind of approach the work the same way.
Your family, your folks, how are they perceiving this thing? Okay. The kid's off to New York. He's doing this. Was it well received, or was it like, what the heck are you doing?
You know, I have to say my father, he didn't get it, but what was important to him is that I just took a huge swing for whatever I really wanted. That's all was really important for him. He could get other people jobs. He could help them out. He just looked at me and he says, I don't know how to help you in this. Mm-hmm. And that was the only thing that really kind of stumped him about the whole thing. It's like, this is a whole world I can't even give you advice on. And my mother, I think she was like just really begging it that it was a phase that was going to pass. just out of her security issue of like, she just wanted me to be okay and be able to take care of myself. And she didn't really understand, like, I think it was confusing for a lot of people because of how shy I was. Like, they thought I was the last person in the world to go swing after a field that could get you a lot of attention. And I think there was always this one moment where my mother was watching some kind of interview. I don't know, might have been The View or one of those interview shows. And Gabriel Byrne was a guest on the show. And him being an Irish actor was really gave him more weight with my parents. And he says, acting is a shy man's revenge. And that was the only time my mother just had this aha moment of like, I get it.
I've never heard that phrase before. That is awesome. So when you were, what kind of studying were you doing? Were you in New York? Was there any kind of specific school or path or theory or something that you just locked onto?
Yeah, I was working a little bit. Like I would book a couple of jobs, and but I felt like I needed something to ground myself and keep me active more. And I had a few people I had worked with that worked with Bill Esper. So I went to the William Esper Studio, which is a Meisner based training program, and it's a studio that's been there for, I think, since maybe the late 60s, early 70s. But Bill was like one of the first teachers that Sanford Meisner trained.
When you started in that studio, was it, who was kind of in your, not class, but you know, who were your, well, who's kind of in there with you?
Well, I'll tell you, you know, cause it's very, you know, it's kind of an old school kind of thing too. Like New York, these studios were, the training is just very hyper-focused and you learn, you know, a specific technique and you become a master of that technique. It's, you know, I think now is more of a, younger people are more kind of curated from grad schools and things like that. But this, this was really, I think the coolest thing about it was I basically went to grad school, like in a way of like, I could bartend and then hand Bill like a wad of cash in his hand and pay him every month for a couple hundred bucks. And I got some of the best training, like some of the greatest actors in the world have trained with Bill. And that was the access. And so your class was very diverse in experience and age and you really bonded with them. You really opened yourself up after 2 years with people of, because it's really about breaking down your instrument and like what are your tells, what are your things that you kind of do to survive in life that don't work on the stage. And it's you go through a lot of psychology with people. So the vulnerability, the shared vulnerability really bonds you. And our particular class, Bill had kept saying to us that it was a special class, and it was, we should stay together and we should work together. And so one person in my class was Amy Schumer. And she, so the first thing we ever produced together was our showcase from that class. And we loved how that went. And so we ended up starting a theater company with the core of the company being that class in New York for almost 11 years, 12 years.
Did you find yourself on a path of like, okay, I want to be an actor or a director or a producer or a writer? What was the thing that was pulling on you the most?
I was just an actor. I think what happened was there was an acknowledgement of this shift going on in the industry and even in theater of where people they were calling their actors from. And we felt like a little bit like we were kind of the mutts. We weren't the pedigrees out there, you know. So it was more in a sense of, okay, we will make our own stuff and make our own waves and make our own kind of attention to kind of beget the things that we're thinking about, like of doing. And so it was in the doing of that, of us kind of raising each other up and taking care of each other, trying to showcase each other, that we were just kind of forced to apply those kind of situations. Like, we're going to learn directing on the fly. We're going to learn producing on the fly. And it was real, really trial and error.
So making your own stuff, everybody thinks like now that's what everybody's doing. You know, you can get out there with you can get out there with your phone and start creating stuff. Back then, sure, that was kind of a novel idea, you know, to just be creative.
Yeah.
You're kind of at the precipice of that. But being in New York, I've talked to a number of people. The Dick Wolf ecosystem, you know, is sort of like, if you're a young actor, you're in New York, you're going to be on one of his shows, you know, that kind of a thing.
Right.
When did you come on board with Law & Order SVU?
Well, you know, I got sort of in the Dick Wolf universe. I just told this story the other night because Law & Order had their big anniversary. I just sort of got off a bus and wasn't here that long and met an agent through a friend and got an audition for Law & Order, and I booked the job before I really had training or knew what I was doing. And
really? Okay.
Like my first onset experience was with Jerry Orbach and and Jesse Martin, and it was, you know, I was just this young scared kid, and Jerry Orbach was kind of getting me through the day and just said, look, kid, you're going to be great. Don't worry about it. You know, and it was just,
oh, that's awesome.
Something that really kind of was overwhelming thinking about it. Their 25th anniversary or 25th season anniversary party. But I would book that here and there. And then right when I graduated from Esper, I had booked a guest lead on SVU. I think like maybe 8-9 years after that, I was booked again as a guest star in an episode that Mariska was directing. And okay. I got the bond with Mariska. I was holding the DA hostage in a bar. That was the episode. So it was very, very focused, and it was a lot, you know, it was a lot to carry. But I kind of think Mariska, you know, kind of kicked my name around when this role now, when Terry Bruno became available, and it was just like the right fit, and it just felt great.
Yeah, every time I hear her name, I think of the Love Guru with where her name was a prayer, you know, or like a, you know, not a prayer, but a greeting or whatever. Big Mike Myers fan. haven't you done some stuff with Bill Hader? Haven't y'all connected as well? Or,
well, I so from our theater company, we used to do this comedy fundraiser because Amy Schumer was starting to do well on stand-up, and we could get these comedians, and we knew how to throw a big party, and Amy sort of bluffed her way into a beer sponsorship. And so, in fact, we had like 30 packs of beer being delivered before we had a show, so we had to come up with a show on the fly. So, you know, bonding like that with Amy was how her and I started to really work together. And when she had an opportunity to do a show, we had just started doing sketches on stage with, you know, like more of a party atmosphere. And so I think Comedy Central originally wanted her to do a talk show after one of her roasts, and she just didn't want it to be a talk show host. She's like, I'm an actor. And so she pitched this sketch comedy show. So she pulled me on to that show and wanted me in there with that show. And we worked on Inside Amy Schumer. When I, you know, was given notes and helping out with the train wreck script, and she had told Judd that I should be on set, and I got to meet Judd, and then Judd and I hit it off, and I was on.
Oh, yes. Wearing... I'm a big Judd fan. Have you gotten his
head? Oh, yeah.
Look how thick that book is. I've got the new Comedy Nerd book, a little unintended plug there, but I've got a comedy crush on Judd. I will say that. So.
Oh, yeah. I'm about to get into the Mel Brooks one tonight, so I can't wait to see that one. But so I was on Trainwreck every day. It was sort of a weekly thing. I'm like, do you want me to come back Monday? He's like, yeah. And then he'd give me and Amy's sister he'd give us assignments to write like alt jokes because he likes to have a million jokes rapid fire in every scene. Yeah. He kind of he directs with a god mic sometimes, in the scenes after they get the scene, then he's just throwing out jokes.
Did he direct Trainwreck or did he produce it?
He directed Trainwreck. If I'm not mistaken, Trainwreck was a big deal for him because it was the first feature that he didn't write.
Oh, really? Okay.
He was very much in the process of like mentoring Amy through the writing of it, but it was Amy's script. So, but I have to say, I kind of came from this stage shows with $20 all you can drink to Inside Amy Schumer, on a very small budget.
What was the timeline of this? Was it a matter of a year or two, or how fast did that happen?
I think Amy and I were doing those shows on stage 2009. Inside Amy Schumer was 2012, and then Trainwreck was 2014. It was
Wow, 5 years is nothing, man. That goes by just
that. Yeah. But it's that kind of complex of dude, am I supposed to be here? Are they going to throw me out of here? What am I doing here? And you're on a studio comedy movie with Judd Apatow, and he's literally willing to take any idea and listen to you and just kind of teach you. And it's just, he's such a beautiful human being in that way that he just he focuses on the positive, and he just keeps a lot of love around him during the making of everything. That it was kind of an eye-opening experience to be around.
Yeah, I've heard him. I think it was outtakes, but bits from I think it was Anchorman or something, where he'll throw out like you said, Bill Hader will throw out lines. Did he do that? Did he do that with y'all, where he's throwing out? Okay. Just to kind of see how it would sound coming out.
It was so fun to, tomorrow it's John Cena. So now you're going to write all these kind of crazy things that John Cena would say. Or sometimes, depending on who was in town and the ability to do it, he was trying to throw together this crazy intervention scene that wasn't really in the original script. And it's who's coming? Marv Albert, LeBron James, Chris Everett. We got to write something for all these people to say in an intervention. And it just felt like a kid. There was a video game when I was a kid called NBA Jams that Marv Albert was the voice of. Just all of these, if a player was dunking from far away, it'd be from downtown, in Marv Albert's voice. And so, you're just giving lines for Marv to feed Marv Albert to say, to see if I can get LeBron to laugh. Cause he knew what was happening, and it was, and I was is this real life? I can't believe this just came together on a Tuesday out on a random. And it's just one of those kind of fun things on a movie set where it can be so much hard work, but that movie in retrospect just felt like play every day.
Fast forward to Law and Order. One thing I'm curious about is if you're on Law and Order and you're walking down the street, people know you're on the show. How do the New York cops relate to y'all? Do they watch the show? Are they plugged in? Do they think it's cool or you don't know what it's really like?
No, the opposite. I think they're very into it. They're very appreciative. I've never met one that wasn't excited about it. And I've I've been around some cops that are thankful that they're portrayed in a light that they care, that they, you know. So I think Dick Wolf does a good job of presenting that side that I think that they feel like can be missing a lot.
As far as the drama-based stuff, like, you know, one thing I still have not seen is the Irishman.
Uh-huh.
You know, the Scorsese thing. You're in New York, so being in a Scorsese film, you know. What was that experience like for you to, you know, and De Niro, and, you know, in, wasn't Joe Pesci in that as well? Or am I just imagining that?
He was, yeah, okay. Yeah. You know, it's funny is I knew a little bit of The Irishman because he was from Philadelphia, and I knew older people had told stories about him before. Like, mm-hmm. And he was a Teamster where my grandfather was friends with a few of the Teamsters that he was with. So I knew a little bit about the story, but when I got the role, you know, I wasn't exactly sure what I was auditioning for. And it was one of those times where I felt very old for the first time, because I was very disappointed that I was like, I wanted like a 1940. I wanted to be in a period. I wanted to try something. And I was very thankful I was in, but I'm like, I'm going to be in the 90s part of the story. So whatever.
I haven't seen it because you got to make a commitment. It's like a 3+ hour movie. And yeah, yeah.
So our stuff was just with De Niro when he was a very old man. So I go in for a fitting and I'm like, I lived during this era. Like, I'm going to put on a 90s suit. And I just looked in the mirror. I was like, holy, oh my God, people wore this? Like, it felt I was like, oh my God, a part of my life feels like a period piece now. Now I feel like I'm getting older.
Yeah. God, yeah. Isn't that the weirdest thing when you look at pictures of what you were wearing in the 90s And a phrase I've said last couple of chats I've had is like, if you look, you know, if you don't look back on yourself in your 20s and think you were a knucklehead, you're still a knucklehead. But when you do look back, go, God, what was I thinking? Yeah. And the fashions weren't too outrageous because, I mean, we went through the 80s. I mean, you know, that was pretty out there. But what's not necessarily easier for you, but what is it that you prefer? Is it the on camera or is it the off camera? Where do you feel the work, you know, the second part of the question is, where do you feel the workload the most? Like, if you are on camera, do you feel like, okay, this is a lot of work? Or is it when you're sitting down, blinking cursor, trying to write something and come up and be creative?
No, I don't, I always feel, you know, a lot of the projects where you have to wear three hats on, I always like, oh, well, I have to be here for every shot, or I'm at Video Village from, you know, the whole time, and the actors get to go home when they're done their scenes. And so I always assumed it was the reverse, but I think when you're just an actor all the time, it is, I feel it is more mentally draining than for me personally, than being there on set, because I get a charge out of meeting the new actor on set. I get a charge of making things work, and it kind of revives you. I feel like with the acting, you're just there to give, you give, and then, you know, hope it works out. So I, for me personally, I feel like, just the acting is to me is the most grueling part.
As we kind of wrap up, one of the things I love doing is something I call my 7 questions. Do mm-hmm. this with everybody, just a little extra fun, a little extra get to know you. And I always like talking food at least one time during our show. And I'm curious, as a Philly guy, what is your favorite comfort food? If you, great day, crummy day, either way, it's just like, it just lands for you.
I think that's influenced by a lot of my friends, especially my friends' mothers. I would have to say Italian. I that's my Italian is the comfort food for me.
Anything in particular?
I mean, like, there's nothing like just a great sauce and a bowl of pasta after, like, I was Friday night, I was chasing a guy for about 4 different setups in 10 degree weather. And nothing feels better than that when you're done.
I think you having the real deal Italian food is, you know, I'm quite envious. Now, next question is, now, if you're going to for a few hours, sit down, have a cup of coffee or two or three with 3 people, living or not, who would those 3 people be you would like to be sitting at the table with for a few hours, having a conversation and talking story?
Living or not? Ooh, that's a tough one. I would say Amy Schumer's and I have a great time together, and we kind of use each other to kind of touch base into reality. So that she's always a good anchor for me. And then the other, I think, there's this bar, that everyone's trying to save in New York right now. It's called Jimmy's Corner. And the owner who had passed during COVID, his name was Jimmy Glenn, and he is a kind of boxing cut man, manager legend. He's sort of a Harlem legend. He's a guy who had like Miles Davis as his best man at his wedding. He's just this kind of colorful, wonderful life. And he was just always full of mesmerizing stories. And I think a lot of the stuff Amy and I worked on, we kind of dreamed up in that bar. So I think that would be a fun threesome.
Anybody else you'd like to add into that mix?
I just love being around funny people. Like somebody like Colin Quinn is somebody that is just a joy to be around. And I don't know, Judd is just, I found myself interested in so many of the things he was interested in, and we kind of bonded in that way. That would just be just a fun table.
Yeah, I'd love to be at that table next to y'all, just kind of eavesdropping in on what y'all got going on. You know, going back to when you were a kid, who was your very first celebrity crush?
Celebrity, you mean like an admiration?
Oh, it could be an admiration or someone who you like.
Or you mean like a female crush that I had?
A female crush, you know, TV, film, you know.
My brother used to watch this show, Charles in Charge.
Oh, yeah.
I had a crush on this girl, Nicole Eggert.
Didn't she end up doing a Baywatch? Or am I imagining that?
Something. Yes, I think so. Yeah. And I ended up in an acting class with her in L.A. when I was in L.A. for a little period, and I took this acting class, and we did a scene together, and that was very surreal. But I kept that buried deep down.
Yeah. There are those moments you're like, I'm a professional, but my inner teenager is going, this is awesome. Now, if you were to live on an exotic island, you know, you got to be there for an entire year, somewhere you want to be. It's not rough living. You know, you're not there with Wilson the volleyball or anything. But there's no streaming. So if you want to watch them, you only get one movie to watch all year long. You got a DVD you can bring with you. And you also have an album you can listen to over and over. So it's one DVD or one CD, or I'll even say like a box set. But that's all you can bring. What are you taking to the island with you?
Ooh, one DVD. It's really, these are always my hardest questions because I could do one per decade, but I think I'll have to stay on the Jimmy Cagney theme, and I think I'd have to say Angels with Dirty Faces. Do you know that movie?
I'm not familiar with it, but I'd love hearing about, this is how I find out about things I need to go check out, is when I talk with folks who are like, they mention something I haven't seen before, and I'm like, I'm going to go check that out now.
There's something about this movie to me that the device of the ending of this movie, where it's Pat O'Brien is his best friend growing up, and they're getting trouble as kids, and they go in two different directions. So Jimmy Cagney, of course, becomes the crime boss, and Pat O'Brien becomes the priest. And Pat O'Brien's in charge of these kids, and these kids are worshiping Jimmy Cagney, and he's going to the electric chair, and Pat O'Brien has a meeting with him and says, please, can you just not go out a hero for these kids? I'll never get them back. They'll worship you forever. And he gets into a fight and he sends his best friend away. And then the march to the electric chair, he starts to break. And you have to decide whether he's doing it for his friend or he's really going through it. And the movie doesn't tell you, and it just makes you choose what you want. And I always... and fascinated by the end of that movie.
Yeah, there's something about that era. In fact, I was watching something I was looking, don't even know how I stumbled across it, is on YouTube, is Margot Robbie was, I guess she bartended in Australia, and she was talking about her making a few of her favorite drinks, and she was talking about how she loved watching movies back. They just shot them differently because the technical, the way they could set up camera shots and, you know, the wide, and when they went in for a tight, the movies are just made different. And she said, you know, the way the costuming, and it was just a different And I was like, you know, I never really thought about that. And, you know, the way they did close-ups were just these, you know, it was just different, you know. So there's something special about that era, which is kind of fun to rediscover it, you know. And so, like, I love hearing about these movies because now I got to go see if Turner Classic Movies has this now. So I got to go do some rummaging. Next question, if you were to say, okay, today is a perfect day, what are the component parts for you? What would be a perfect day for you from beginning to end? What are the things that are kind of the recipe for that perfect day?
You know, when you were asking about acting or directing and producing things like that, like my experience from directing and producing has just been with friends. And when we would do Inside Amy Schumer, we would be able to get all these friends on. We would be able to get these actors that we wanted to work with on. And it was that kind of thing. So I think a creative day for me where we can kind of explore and I had this day like on my first season on SVU as this character where in the morning I was shooting a scene with Amy Schumer and Cola Scola. And the episode was about something very personal that happened to me that we were able to put out there. And at lunch, I got in a van and I rode to SVU and I was with Ice-T and prostitutes on a city street in New York at night. And I couldn't imagine of a more polar opposite day or a more perfect day. It was just all the elements of everything happening to me coming together. But I think there's no higher feeling. Like it was a very full day, but it's a very fun day.
Do you ever pinch yourself and go, I get to do this? This is my gig?
Yeah, all the time. Yeah. And I think for me, it was like whether we were doing it in a small theater for just to challenge ourselves or there where there's a lot at stake, you know, you're responsible for a lot. Like I think just watching other people shine or being able to come together and get something to elevate is just the high that I chase all the time.
That is very cool. That is very cool. I'm envious right now. Now, last couple questions I got. One of them is, if you weren't doing this, if somebody said, "Yeah, hey, Kevin, the whole acting thing, it's not possible for you anymore." What would be the next thing that you'd be like, "This is what I want to do. This is what brings you joy."
Well, I had this question before. This was a big Bill Esper question. And he would make everybody in the class close their eyes and try to think in detail about what it is. Whenever they came up with something very specific, he invited them to use the door because this business will make you quit. So I don't have an answer to that. I think when I was younger, I probably would say I would like to be like a boxer or that was like the sport I was most interested in.
Well, they say that if you can imagine yourself, if you imagine yourself doing something else, anything that that acting probably isn't for you. But if you can't imagine doing anything else, that this is, you know, it's worth the effort.
It's almost a compulsion than it is.
Well, the last question I got for you, if you can jump into that DeLorean and you can cruise back to when you were 16 years old and you've got a piece of advice for yourself, either to take that moment of your life and make it a little bit better or to put yourself on a little different trajectory or just a piece of advice to 16-year-old you, what would that be?
I think sometimes we think there's this some kind of fence we're being shut out of, you know, like some fence, like if we can just get over it into this business and to like then and things will come and everything and you'll be accepted and this is, but until you're over that fence, you never feel like you're there, you know. Mm-hmm. And I think I would just advise myself that it's just a marathon and it's there, that never happens. And what gets you there is just putting your mind to the things that matter to you, the creative work that matters to you, and to culminate the people that matter to you around you. Because it's really through the network you make and the relationships you make that those are the things that will get you there.
Yeah, but telling the young man to be patient, that's a challenge right there.
Yeah.
Well, Kevin, man, thank you so much. Going to check you out on Law & Order SVU, you and Ice-T and the prostitutes. No, I'm just kidding. real quick, anything, any projects going to be coming out outside of that? Anything in the pipeline?
No, we're shooting SVU for another couple of months, and then I have a couple of things that I'm hoping to jump on as soon as it's over, but it's still working that out right now.
Awesome. Well, man, go have yourself a wonderful rest of your week, and hopefully we'll have an opportunity to catch up down the line.
Yeah, that sounds good, man. I appreciate it. It was great talking to you.
Okay, there you go. Kevin Kane. Really enjoy the sit down. Real cool guy. Of course, you can check him out on Law and Order SVU. It is on NBC. Of course, just a real cool guy to sit down and talk with. Really enjoyed the conversation. Hey, do me a favor, if you would. Don't forget to follow Story and Craft on your favorite podcast app. That way you get notified every time a new episode rolls out. And also, we are on Substack. So just go to storyandcraft.substack.com. That way you get notified with an email every time a new episode rolls out, or if we got some kind of fun mischief going on. It's a cool way to stay up to date. Also, the website, storyandcraftpod.com, all information you could possibly want to know about this show, past guests, past episodes, it's all up there for you. But I'm going to jump on out of here. Time for me to grab a bite to eat and for you to go enjoy the rest of your day. And as always, thank you so much for making what I got going on here part of whatever you've got going on. It is more appreciated than you know. And I look forward to connecting with you next week for another episode of Story and Craft. We'll talk to you next time.
That's it for this episode of Story and Craft. Join Mark next week for more conversation right here on Story and Craft. Story and Craft is a presentation of Mark Preston Productions, LLC. Executive producer is Mark Preston. Associate producer is Zachary Holden. Please rate and review Story and Craft on Apple Podcasts. Don't forget to subscribe to the show on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or your favorite podcast app. You can subscribe to show updates and stay in the know. Just head to storyandcraftpod.com and sign up for the newsletter. I'm Emma Dillon. See you next time, and remember, keep telling your story.
Hello, hello. We want to talk to you about the Make It podcast. I'm your host, Chris Barkley.
And I'm your host, Nicholas Bugs. And Chris, this is something I love to talk about.
Yeah, the Make It podcast. It's already hard enough to make it as a creative. So give yourself a little advantage and listen to the Make It podcast. You know, it's a lot more than just a podcast about film and filmmakers. It's a podcast, Nick, about me and you as well. And we really have a lot of fun.
We do, man. And I will tell you, the guests are amazing.
Guests are amazing. Segments are amazing. We segment out the whole show. We teach you things in a fun way. Audience polls, things we should know, trivia, and leave you a little happier than before you started listening.
Yeah, for sure, man. Like you always say, we bat 1,000.
We educate, we entertain, we inspire.
Not only with our guests, but just with having a good time.
So give yourself a little advantage and listen to the Make It podcast. You can find us on YouTube. Just search for the Make It podcast or wherever you listen to podcasts. And once you're there, be sure to subscribe, rate, and review.
Yeah, man, for sure. And as we always say, come to the Make It podcast where you can be better, be creative, be engaged.
And thank you for listening, guys.